Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, now the internet folk are with us. We have two options. Since you were all just talking about how quickly we may or may not get through the book of Numbers, we can either dive straight into the book of Numbers, which gets very statistical for the next couple of chapters, or I also came prepared to talk about the religion of Darwinism some more.
Let's do that.
We can do either one. We really can. I mean, it's a wide open field. But you know that I said a couple of weeks ago that I spent a whole evening talking about the link, and I've gotten some very positive feedback. And I'm very fortunate because people give me and send me and mail me and hand me all kinds of different material once they know that I'm into something. And I've been reading a lot of evolutionary theory and Darwinistic theory lately.
Well, Jim, it is such a hot topic in the educational world now.
It certainly is, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Time to do it.
So I said a couple of weeks ago here that Darwinism has all the hallmarks of a religion, and that they have even named their God. They've given their God a name. They've established their prophet, obviously Charles Darwin. They have their rituals, and they have their God, and their God is named natural selection. And I made that comment, and I kept going. Tonight I brought you a little bit of evidence from their own literature showing you that they are accrediting natural selection with an intelligence and a forcefulness and a power that is equal to a creator. It's just that they call him natural selection. So that makes it scientific. Because there's a certain unavoidable reality that the complexity of life on Earth, everything from plant to human to animal to all the different variations, to explain how it is that there is that kind of variation, requires that there be some kind of force that is moving creatures constantly upward. And so they've named their God. Now, in the Bible, according to Paul in Romans 1 and 2, he says that the fact that the cosmos exists is proof that God exists, that man is without excuse, because as soon as you look into the heavens and you see the design of the heavens, that you see a designer. A designer is automatic in the fact that the heavens and the cosmos exists. And for any person who understands that concept, the cosmos, the universe, is sufficient. You can point to it and say, there's the universe. God made the universe. The fact that the universe exists proves God. Well, that's exactly what the Darwinists are now doing. They're using that exact argument. Because whatever you are convinced of, you will see that thing that you are convinced of everywhere you look. Let me give you a completely separate example. Let's say that you're a tribe that believes that there is a god of the volcano, and every time the volcano erupts, it's because the god is angry. Well, then every time there's a volcanic eruption, that is proof to you that the god exists, and he's angry because here comes the eruption. You follow the logic? Once you accept the premise, then whenever you see the activity take place that you have based on your premise, you will use the activity to justify or validate the premise that you placed on the action. Did you follow me? Did I lose anybody there? And so the Darwinists are arguing that natural selection is the process by which the variation of species came about, and then they point to the variation in species to say, see? The fact that there is variation in species proves natural selection. So natural selection is the way that species became various species, and then they point to the various species and say, see, that proves that natural selection works. It's a very circular argument. But if you listen to the language that they use, it's very obvious that they have deified natural selection. Now, of course, natural selection in and of itself as a concept is a valid concept. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, whatever it was, when I talked about the link, after I got done talking about it, Tom said to me, well, you know, within a species, natural selection does take place. And I agree with that completely, and thought I had said that more clearly than apparently I did. I completely agree that there is variation within a species, and there is adaptation within a species, undoubtedly. The one thing the Darwinists have not yet been able to prove is that variation within a species somehow becomes a completely separate and distinct species. That they have not been able to prove. But they will tell you that that's how it works. I don't know where I got this magazine. I got this recently. Was this one somebody here gave me? I've been getting a lot of Darwin stuff lately. This is Discover Magazine. Discover Magazine for March 2009, Are We Still Evolving? They're very... I just noticed that. That came from you. That's the Foster family. Well, there you go. You've already read this then.
I haven't.
Well, then you can have it back because I've read it. This is a remarkable magazine in as much as it is a science magazine, and they are just all a Twitter over the 150th anniversary of Darwin's theory being published and the 200th anniversary of his birth. And so this particular edition of the magazine has the long shadow of Darwin in it. Talk a lot about the ascent of Darwin and show you the pictures of, you know, a monkey hand next to some human bones and say, oh, look how similar we are. I'm going to read right from that article, The Ascent of Darwin, and just listen to this language. The universal appeal of Darwin's theory lies in its central tenet, natural selection, or survival of the fittest. That tenet states that organisms best suited to their circumstances will be the ones most likely to reproduce, spreading their adaptive traits and driving out the competition. We would agree with that within a species. We would say, sure, that if you see a herd of elk, the sick ones fall behind and get eaten by the lions. The healthier ones that can run faster are the ones that live another day to reproduce healthier elk. We agree with that concept. So now that we've said what they mean by natural selection, they're now going to expand that meaning far beyond just the notion of competition within a species. Natural selection creates a dynamic, ever-changing biota. What was the verb in that sentence?
Creates.
Natural selection is a phrase. Natural selection is just two words that are used to describe a theory or a concept. Natural selection as a thing can't create anything. Natural selection doesn't create. Even by definition, if we use the definition that we just read, that natural selection is the process of sicker animals dying off and healthier, more fit animals being able to reproduce and pass along healthier traits. That still doesn't create anything, does it?
No, it doesn't.
No. So what does create?
Creator.
A creator. See, I keep telling you that the language of natural selection is the language of a god. They just call their god natural selection. Natural selection creates a dynamic, ever-changing biota driven to evolve by genetic variation. So now natural selection drives. Driven to evolve. If something is driven to evolve, that means that there is a force upon that thing, forcing it forward, driving it in a creative way to evolve ever upward. Is that science, by the way?
No.
No, you know what that is? It's the language of religion. That's the language of faith. Couldn't I just as easily say to you, God creates a dynamic, ever-changing biota, and God drives genetic variation. Couldn't I say that just as easily? And it'd be a perfectly valid sentence. All you do is insert natural selection, you've got the same sentence. Scientists have created their own God and given him a name. Let's see, not only does natural selection create a dynamic, ever-changing biota, driven to evolve by genetic variation, adaptation to different environments, competition for limited resources, and cooperative exchanges among individuals, all of that is the result of natural selection. Isn't that something? That little two-word phrase is very busy. Very busy creating and driving and forcing. It's very interesting that it can do all that. Natural selection explains how, from simple beginnings, the diversity and complexity of living things arose. Does natural selection actually explain that? Why it is that from the first cell that sprang to life in the primordial ooze and then began inexplicably dividing into more complex cellular structures, and then some of those continuously more complex cellular structures became plants and tomatoes and fir trees, and others became giraffes and monkeys and Tom. You're only a couple steps away from tomato in that sentence.
T-O-M,
he's halfway there. Tom-ado. Does natural selection actually explain it? They've yet to explain it. They've yet to show us. In fact, within all of Darwinistic theory, they've yet to identify the progressive progenitor or the progressive result of any animal species. In other words, they can't tell you what a cow evolved from, what its immediate predecessor is. There is no chart anywhere. We've all gone to school. We all took science classes. We all took biology and chemistry in those classes. In those classes, although they could show you drawings of chimpanzees little by little standing erect, and then they could tell you based on those drawings that that's the way men evolved from monkey to Homo sapien. Of course, these are just drawings. They just made that up and said, no, that's the way it works. And then you force feed that to kids, and kids go, well, that must be how it worked. Except that they have absolutely no scientific proof that that's the way it happened. And a couple weeks ago when we talked about the link, remember that one of the reasons that the scientists were so excited about finding this particular fossil was that they admitted, we've never had any proof before. Now we have what we claim is proof. They know that the theory is vacuous when it comes to actual scientific proof that they can lay in front of you and say, this is the moment in time where a horse became a cow. And not just one cow, because if only one cow suddenly burst on the scene, then it would die and there'd be no more cows. There have to be several cows that sprang from horses all around the same period of time so that those cows could reproduce and make more cows. And yet there's not a single fossil bit of evidence or genetic bit of evidence to ever show or prove that any species evolved from another species. And despite that glaring, huge, gaping hole where the evidence ought to be, we've been told that natural selection explains it. The principle of natural selection really is a third way of thinking, says evolutionist David Sloan Wilson of Birmingham University in New York. In his book, Evolution for Everyone, he distinguishes natural selection from theological thinking, which would be God did it, and mechanistic thinking, its parts make it work this way. Natural selection is a source of insight that is unbelievably powerful, Wilson says. And its power is not limited to life sciences. The same selective paradigm can describe the rise of complexity in inanimate systems, stock markets, transit schedules. In other words, once you believe natural selection, you see it everywhere. No matter where you look, oh, natural selection did that. Though other mathematic models are capable of simulating complex phenomena. Only Darwin's approach shows how certain complex systems not only arise, but also adapt over time to the constraints imposed by their environment, as living systems do. Listen carefully. This process... Oh, okay, so now it's a process, and it's a power, and it's a force. Notice the language that gives it life, that gives it creative ability. The only process that is known to generate adaptive complexity is natural selection. Generate? The verb there was generate. The only process known to generate adaptive complexity is natural selection, unless there's a God. Now, if there's a God, he would be the only process or force or mind or creator who created complexity and variation.
Jim?
Yes?
I don't know when natural selection evolved into an entity that could do these things, but my degree is in biology, among other things, and this kind of wording and these concepts did not exist in the university in the early 70s.
Right.
They weren't there.
Right. This is all new stuff that these supposedly groundbreaking, razor's edge scientists are discovering and coming up with. But all that's evolving, as you pointed out, is the language.
I'm just wondering if this language is actually being used in the university classroom, or is it being used to put out on the media?
Well,
that's media.
It's media.
Well, that's right. But if you go into a ecology class in a university, are they going to talk this way?
Probably.
He's a professor.
We have
probably.
A biologist down at the Florida Wildlife, and he's got daughters going to Christian colleges, and he's been asking what their thoughts are on evolution versus creation. And surprisingly, a lot of the Christian colleges teach evolution and don't necessarily teach creation.
That's no books published.
Yeah. That's the power of the publishing. That's exactly right. And understand that your beginning, very much like philosophy, begins with the concept of no God. And now that there's no God, let's explain why we're here. What's the meaning of life without God? That's philosophy. This, that is being disguised as science, actually is a religious philosophy. And it's starting with there's no God, so now how did we get here? And the one postulate that they won't even consider is the notion of a creator. And yet the complexity of life screams creator. And so they are now giving natural selection creative characteristics to explain the complexity. Because the complexity screams wisdom, intelligence, design. And so they have to say, but there is no God to design it, but we need a designer. So we're going to call it natural selection, and we're just going to hope that nobody pulls back the curtain and goes, there's really nobody behind that curtain that we're calling natural selection.
And the probability of it runs such a preposterous number that even the 47 million is not going to...
Yeah, give it 47, 50 million years. You know what's very funny about this magazine too, Gladys, is that a big section of this magazine, because it's a science magazine, ostensibly, a lot of it is dedicated to global warming. And what are we going to do about global warming? And it seems to me that the answer to global warming is, we'll adapt. Wouldn't that be what would happen? If Darwinism was true, then the Earth would get warmer and humans would just adapt to it. But instead, they're like in panic mode about global warming. We got to fix it. We got to change it. It could be the end of all humanity. And I think, have you read the next article? Because the next article says that, you know, we're just adapting all the time. Anyway, the only process that is known to generate adaptive complexity is natural selection, says evolutionary biologist Massimo Pigliucci, or something like that, of Stony Brook University in New York. That was Darwin's major insight, his fundamental contribution. But what we're doing today, as Tom said, is going far beyond what Darwin would have ever dreamed of. In what? In their language. All right, I'm just going to skip forward for a moment because there's so much here. But amid the hordes of converts to Darwinism, two groups remain conspicuous holdouts. It'd be the two guys in the back. Conspicuous holdouts.
Along with global warming.
Exactly. Those two groups are artists and religious believers.
Artists?
Hey, it's not my magazine. It's your magazine. You went, artists? Artists are, quote, likely to regard science in general and evolution in particular as irrelevant to their concerns or even as a threat to everything they hold dear, David Sloan Wilson writes in Evolution for Everyone. Yet he sees evolutionary theory breaching even that resistance. In 2005, Wilson co-edited The Literary Animal, a collection of essays applying Darwinian concepts to literary analysis. Literature, he says, is, quote, the fossil record of cultural evolution. If you're an evolutionist and you like to read, every time you pick up a novel, the evolutionary themes just jump out at you. See, if you buy the theory, you see it everywhere. Then he lists, now pay attention, he then lists the evolutionary themes that leap out of every book that he reads. And those themes are sex, death, kinship, competition, and self-sacrifice. Hold it. Everybody kind of went, whoa, what? Yeah, where in evolutionary theory and survival of the fittest do you find self-sacrifice?
Not there.
No, it doesn't exist in there. No, it's all about the survival of the fit so that they can live and procreate. It's all about live another day, make the next generation of animals. That's what natural selection is supposed to accomplish.
Well, I guess it could be argued that the mother protects the better children because they're advancing her mother.
I'm guessing. He's claiming it's in there somewhere. Kinship, self-sacrifice, and competition, he claims, are all evolutionary themes that we find in literature. The very existence of art begs to be explained in evolutionary terms, Wilson says. Artistic expression has all the earmarks of a genetically evolved capacity. It appears early in life. It's enjoyable for its own sake. It exists across all cultures and is mediated by ancient neural pathways in the brain. Evolutionary psychologist Jeffrey Miller of the University of New Mexico suggests that art evolved as a way for potential mates to show off their intellectual fitness. Which means that when the cave-dwelling males were trying to attract a mate, she was not as impressed with the one that could bring home food as she was the one that could draw on the wall.
Put the heart with the arrow through it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Sure, he can bring home a buffalo, but I can draw a buffalo. I read those kind of statements and I just think that is remarkable gibberish.
You have to be smart to create that.
But wait, we haven't gotten to the religious part yet. Wilson thinks art, especially the collective making of it, is common in traditional cultures, and that gives a selective advantage because it helps to organize cooperative behavior. The same reasoning applies to religion, he argues. His studies have documented ways in which religious feeling and organization confer survival benefits on believers by promoting cooperation within and sometimes between groups. Quote, a given religion adapts its members to their local environment, enabling them to achieve by collective action what they cannot achieve alone or even together in the absence of religion. Wilson writes, the primary benefit of religion takes place in this world, not in the next. The religious emphasis on otherworldly beliefs evolved, Wilson says, because supernatural explanations seem to motivate human cooperation better than factual explanations. From the evolutionary perspective, it does not matter what you believe as long as that belief works and gives you a selective advantage. Did you follow that? Did you get that?
Where did the genetics go to?
Where'd what?
Where did the genetics go to? Did somebody disappear?
Yeah, the genetics disappeared completely. Yeah, and religion evolved because it was helpful in cooperative communities. That if you could bring people to believe the same thing, they were more likely to cooperate with each other, and that was an advantage in survival.
How does Moloch in a church burning the babies help?
There's the big point, Jeff. That's exactly what I thought when I read that. I thought, now, wait a minute. The history of religion is just the opposite. The history of religion says that most religions you adhere to are violently opposed. And there is no survival benefit to being part of that religion. And in fact, early Christianity was violently opposed not only by the Jews, but by the Romans. And if you were found to be Christian or had any religious Christian literature in your home, they wouldn't just kill you, they would first torture and kill your babies in front of you, which means that your survival and the survival of your family was truncated at that very point, that very moment, and all you had to do was deny the religion, which, if it's just an evolutionary idea, then the best way to survive and procreate is to deny the religion. Religion would have devolved, not evolved. And yet, if you start with the concept there is no God, and then you look at a world that is largely religious, you have to say, well, how did religion evolve? And why did religion evolve? And it always has to get back to, well, in some way, it has to help with procreation and survival. So in what way does religion help with procreation and survival? Well, chicks love religious guys. I don't know. What else you got? Yes? I expected a much bigger laugh at chicks like religious guys.
If we were to bring back Darwin today and address us, he'd say, I didn't write any of this stuff. Yeah. I disavow it all, and those neo-Darwinists are crazy.
Yeah. By the way, as long as we're into that kind of notion that religion evolved and art evolved, I love this little sentence. Practitioners of evolutionary medicine analyze patterns of disease and morbidity by considering the deep history of our species. From that perspective, it becomes clear that humans are prone to obesity because our bodies evolved in an environment of scarcity where consuming as much high-energy food as possible was a useful survival strategy. So we're all overweight and obese now because a long time ago that was a survival strategy that is now killing us, and we're too stupid to evolve away from it, apparently.
And you know what else is funny? Is chicks like skinny guys. Right.
Anyway, so, okay, one more quote out of here. This is the Discover interview with Sean Carroll, a molecular biologist, traces the ancient machinery of evolution to a master toolkit of genes and finds that you and a fruit fly have a lot in common. That's, yeah. I'm just going to read one little section because it's a big, long, complex article. You've said that evolution is like compounding interest. How so? Just like a good money market account, evolution works through incremental change. If variants within a species provide an advantage, no matter how slight, then that form, that capacity, will be favored. If evolving spots on wings makes you more attractive to mates or more evasive to predators, those patterns will dominate. Those varieties will then have more offspring. Added up over centuries, millennia, and longer periods of time, natural selection is powerful enough to forge all the changes that we've seen on the face of the earth.
Okay.
Natural selection now has power. Natural selection is now powerful.
Around.
It didn't leave any evidence, no, but it's a force and it drives. All I'm saying is, over and over again, that they have given a name to their God. The name of their God is natural selection.
It sounds like they think it's the only power in the universe.
Well, of course they believe it's the only power in the universe because they start with the concept there is no God. any scientist that's willing to accept that God exists doesn't have to go through these kind of machinations, because he can explain the variation and even the existence of everything. It's God.
Stephen Hawking doesn't have any kids, right?
I don't think so.
Mr. Brilliant is not going to procreate. He's probably not going to survive real long. I mean,
right.
You know,
yeah.
And I'm not attacking him as a person. I'm just saying so many of these really smart people don't have kids.
Yeah.
And look who is having lots of kids.
Yes, and
yeah. Thank you, Sam. No, I was in the general population. You know, it's
You're right. You're right. It is the lower classes who can get more money from the government if they have more kids. Those are the ones that are really populating like mad.
Yeah, that's why we had you, Sam, so we could get more money.
Exactly. No, okay. I just find this hysterical. At the end of this interview, the interviewer says, "You've presented." I just love this sentence because apparently they don't even read what they write. "You've presented an avalanche of irrefutable evidence." "Yet, opponents of evolution seem to refute it all. How do you respond?"
"If it's irrefutable, then..."
Ta-da! There you go. We have a winner. "If it's irrefutable, how is it that your opponents keep refuting it?" You want your magazine? You're welcome to it. I've read all the way through it.
I don't read them, but I might look at that one.
It's just remarkable. You'll ignore my little pen markings. It's just remarkable. All right. We're in the book of Numbers. Chapter 3 of the book of Numbers. If I can get one concept across tonight, it'll be sufficient. Very early on in the book of Genesis, Adam and Eve are driven from the garden. That's right, I'm starting at the beginning again. Adam and Eve were driven from the garden, and they had two sons, Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel both brought sacrifices to God. God accepted one, rejected the other. As soon as men fell, you see God choosing and selecting. Happens right away. You start reading about the patriarchs. Abraham has a son. His oldest son, God says, that's not going to be your son. That's not the one that you're going to have the inheritance through. You're going to have the inheritance through a child of promise, Isaac. And God chooses the younger. And God gives the inheritance to the younger. "In Isaac shall thy seed be called." God picks, God chooses. Of course, we all know that Rebekah had two children in her womb, Jacob and Esau. Not only was it written about in Genesis, it's picked up in the last book of the Old Testament and then recited again in the book of Romans, Romans 9. "Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated." While the children were still in the womb, Paul says, "Having done neither good nor evil, it was said, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated." God picks, God chooses. He has always been that way. He has always acted that way. Out of all the nations on the earth and all the peoples on the earth, he chose Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and he promised them a land and an inheritance, and that their offspring and their descendants would always be God's chosen people. And God uses that language, "Israel, my chosen." Isaiah uses that language, and that language is picked up again in Romans 11, when Paul says that though they were enemies of the gospel, they are beloved for the Father's sake and because of the election. And so this language permeates the Old Testament, permeates the New Testament, and in fact, the New Testament writers use God's activity in the Old Testament to say, our theology of election is proven by the fact that the Old Testament says all the way through it that God picks, God chooses. God chose a nation of people. He chose the Israelites, and among the Israelites, he gave them the priesthood, and he gave them his word, and he gave them the covenants, and he gave them the tabernacle. He gave them their deliverance out of Egypt and then made them a national people and then covenanted with them in eternal covenants to give them a land and that they would be his people and he would be their God forever. Those are promises that he didn't at the same time make with any other people group on the planet, because God picks, God chooses. Then, as God was taking Israel out of Egypt, he killed all the firstborn of Egypt, and he didn't kill the firstborn of Israel. As a consequence, God said, "Now all your firstborn have been purchased to me. I have redeemed them to myself. The fact that I killed all the firstborn of Egypt and did not kill your firstborn, but I covered them with blood. You had to have that lamb's blood on the door. And if you had blood on the door, the death angel would pass by and not kill your firstborn. Therefore, God said that that blood redeemed the firstborn to him and that they then belong to him. Put shoe leather on this for a while. Now we got all those big concepts. So you are Barb and Joe Israelite. And you were born in Egypt. I was going to come up with more Jewish names. Came up with Barb and Joe. And you've lived your whole life in Egypt. In fact, you were born and got married and had your kids before Moses ever came around. You're somewhere in your 40s now, and you know, you've got your kids, you're hoping for some grandkids, and then suddenly you hear the big stir that a deliverer has come. And your 430 years are up, and you're going to be delivered. And then you find out we're being delivered soon, and then you find out we're being delivered tonight. And then you hear, put some blood on the door. And so you get an animal, and you take it in, and you kill it, and you put the blood on the door, and sure enough, that night, you hear the screams through all of Egypt, and you hear the wailing in the streets, and you hear all the death, and the next morning, when it's time for you to leave, all the Egyptians, every single household, has death in their household, and there is mourning, and there is grieving, and there are dead bodies, and don't forget that the firstborn of the animals died. There's dead carcasses everywhere. Put shoe leather on it. Now you gather up your family because you ate the night before wearing your sandals, in your clothes, staff in hand, ready to go. You ate your lamb, you ate the herbs, you did everything God said to do, and then you hear it's time to move out, we're going, and a million people are on the move. And then you get to Mount Sinai, and on your way to Mount Sinai, you've gone through periods of no water, and God gave a million people water out of a rock. And you've gone through having no food, and then God buries you in quail. And then he starts giving you manna from heaven every day to eat. You've got all this evidence that God is there and he's for you. He's drowned your enemies in the Red Sea. He's delivered you through all this. And he takes you to Mount Sinai and he says to you, your firstborn are mine. Are you okay with that?
That would scare me.
At Mount Sinai, they've already seen the dark clouds, the lightning, the thunders. They've already said to Moses, that was really scary. You go talk to him. Tell him not to do that anymore. And then Moses comes down and says, God says, all your firstborn belong to him. He's going to conscript them into service. And he didn't ask you. He told you that because he delivered you the way he did, your firstborn belong to him. So give them up. All your firstborn belong to God and are going to go into service. Pardon me?
I would not be happy with God.
Would not be happy with a God like that. That's a very rough God, isn't it? That's a God who does whatever he wants, anytime he wants, any way he wants, with whomever he wants. I mean, this is the same God who, despite how unfair it seems, could say, I prefer Jacob over Esau. Jacob I've loved. In fact, Esau is going to fall under curses.
But you know, if God hadn't spoken to them, they wouldn't be there in the first place.
Exactly. That's God's view. See, the human view is, wow, that's an enormous imposition, God. And that's why God keeps saying to them over and over, I brought you out of Egypt. And he probably said it in that tone of voice. I brought you. It was probably louder.
And you didn't. That was a man.
If I had left you there, you'd be slaves to this day.
And your firstborn would have been dead back there in Egypt.
Absolutely. I brought you out of Egypt, your firstborn are mine.
Right, and now every generation will know, will not forget that.
Yep. So now, at this moment, Numbers 3, now that we've gone through the Genesis and the Exodus and the Leviticus and all the laws and all the rules, and now that we know that the firstborn all belong to God because God says so, and because he has redeemed them, and because he did tell them how to redeem them, because he has put everything in place to take the firstborn from Israel, he then says, you know what? I'll have one tribe to myself instead. I'm going to take the Levites. The tribe of Levi, all the descendants of Levi, are going to belong to me, and I'm going to put them to work. And they're going to work for me forever. And they're going to serve in my tabernacle. They're going to serve me. They're going to do my work. They're going to be my day-to-day working tribe of priestly men who will work for me. And on top of that, they don't get a land inheritance. And so, you know, every 50 years, when the year of Jubilee comes around and everybody gets their land back, you get nothing. You work for me. Does this seem fair? Because now it just went from, okay, each family in Levi, in the tribe of Levi, each family had to give up their firstborn. Now it's, forget the firstborn, I'm taking all of you. I'm taking all of you and I'm putting you to work. You work for me, you do what I tell you to do, and I'm not going to give you any land inheritance. Can God do this? See, my point is real simple. There is a very, very consistent personality profile of God written in the Old Testament. He's very much like he is. He is how he is, which is why he said to Moses, I am that I am. This is me. This is what I'm like. The fact that I exist is sufficient for you. When Pharaoh says to you, who should I say sent me? You say, the God that is. I am. I just am. I am completely self-sufficient, and I do what I want because from his perspective, from God's perspective, and unfortunately the vast majority of what passes for religion in the world today always views God from human perspectives, but from God's perspective, every human, every animal, every planet is his. He does what he wants with his. And when people say, not fair, God says, I'm God. And that's a good answer. He can do whatever he wants with what's his. And we get that. We understand that. Especially parents. We know what it is to say to a kid, don't touch that. Why? Because I said so. And? Because I'm your parent. I will spank you. I will stop you. I'm bigger than you. You will learn to obey my rules, and you can't have that because it's mine. I went to work every day, and I brought home the money to buy that. Therefore, it's mine, and I'll tell you whether or not you can touch it. Don't touch that. It's mine. Jeff, you got anything at home that's just yours? It's just mine.
Sort of.
Yeah. But the concept is the same. And so God does exactly that. That's all the background here to chapter 3, is that God then has the right to do what he wants with what's his. Not only is everybody his, but Israel is his in a special way. He has revealed himself to Israel in a way he hasn't revealed himself to any other people group. Therefore, Israel has a much bigger responsibility. And as long as we're thinking along this train of thought, let me ask you one more question. So Barb and Joe get marched out into the desert. You know, they were eating the leeks and the onions and, you know, having steady food in Egypt, which is why they start complaining as soon as there's no food and no water. Start saying to Moses, what, you bring us out here just to kill us? They get ornery real fast. And then God takes them to the foot of Mount Sinai. And then God shows that he's there and shows his power. And the next thing they know, after they build their calf and go through that whole thing, the next thing they know, that God that's up there has imposed rules on them. And it's a lot of rules. We've been reading through the rules. And God says, this is my covenant with you. And he didn't say, hey, want to make a covenant? He says, this is my covenant with you because you're my people, because I took you out of Egypt. You are my people. Therefore, I'm going to impose this law on you. And if you do it, I'm going to bless you like crazy. Land of milk and honey, no enemies. I'll take care of the wild animals. If you don't do it, which he knew they weren't going to, it's clear from what we read at the end of the book of Leviticus that he knew they weren't going to do it. He says, and if you don't do it, I'll punish you. What did Barb and Joe do to deserve this? Anything? They were just living their lives. Yeah, they just got born into that people group. They just happened to be there, and God interrupted their life and said, now this is how it's going to go. Can God do that?
Yeah, there he is.
There he is. He did. My question then is, does he still? Sure he does. Of course he does. He still interrupts people's lives. It's not always Bob and Joe Israelite. Sometimes it's Carol. And he interrupts her life and says, now you're mine. And I'm going to be putting myself on you for the rest of your life. I'm going to require you to walk different and think different. I'm going to require you to follow me. Isn't that what we've been seeing on Sunday mornings? Jesus saying, you're my sheep. I'm your shepherd. You know my voice. Follow. And then everything that's entailed in follow is part of the Christian responsibility and Christian life. God has the absolute right and authority to place himself, his commands, and his expectations on anybody he wants. And then you are his. You have nothing to say about it. He chose you. But he has this long, long, long history of doing that, is my point. This is not something that the reformers made up. This is not something that Calvin dreamed up after a bad night of spaghetti or something. He didn't wake up one night and go, hey, I think maybe God elects. People will like that. I'll write that down. No, the Bible has said the same thing over and over again. It's very, very consistent. It's very, very continual. Okay, it's almost 8 o'clock, which means everything I just said is introduction, and I have 4 minutes to wrap up tonight's lesson. Chapter 3, verse 1. Now these are the records of the generations of Aaron and Moses at the time when the Lord spoke with Moses at Mount Sinai. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, Nadab, the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the anointed priests, whom he ordained to serve as priests. By the way, how did Aaron and his sons become priests? God assigned it to them. You have to do this now. This is your job now. Now, of course, Nadab and Abihu liked this idea so much that they said, how about we do it our way? You know, sure. Yeah, we'll just, sure, God, okay, I'll bring you the whole fire thing you want, but I don't care for your mixture that much. I'll do it your way, but I'll improve on it. I'll put a little bit of man-made works in it. I'll put a little bit of my personality into it and see if I can improve on God. So verse 4 says, but Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered strange fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. So Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the lifetime of their father Aaron. Wouldn't that be an example of where being in a religion stopped the forward movement and evolution of that family? Never mind. Okay.
Maybe they weren't the fittest.
Maybe they weren't the fittest. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the tribe of Levi near, set them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. Now Aaron the high priest gets 1/13 of 1 million people to serve him. Is that fair? Sure, God just said that's what we're going to do. In exchange for all the firstborn, I'm just going to take a tribe. And they shall perform the duties for him and for the whole congregation before the tent of meeting to do the service of the tabernacle. God just gave them a job. They're going to do the service of the tabernacle. The next couple of chapters are going to describe in detail what each family group within the tribe of Levi has responsibility for where the tabernacle is concerned, which parts they have to take care of, which parts they have to carry, which parts they have to clean, which parts they have to cover, which parts they're responsible for, and they have no choice in the matter. God doesn't say, anybody here want to carry the laver? Anybody good on the laver? No, he just assigns people jobs and says, now go to work. They shall also keep all the furnishings of the tent of meetings, as verse 8. Along with the duties of the sons of Israel to do the service of the tabernacle. God conscripted them into service. You shall thus give the Levites to Aaron and to his sons. They are wholly or completely given to him from among the sons of Israel. So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons that they may keep their priesthood. But the layman who comes near shall be put to death. Now that's interesting. God just said, out of all these people that he brought out of Egypt, and there's no difference between them, they're all Israelites. They're descendants of 12 sons of Jacob who had his name changed to Israel. It's not like the Levites were the good ones. It's not like they were the better tribe. But then God says, now the Levites, they're going to serve in my tabernacle. And they're going to camp right up close to the tabernacle, like we saw last week. And they're going to camp on all four sides of the tabernacle to create a buffer zone between me and the other 12 tribes. So that the other 12 tribes are safe from my wrath. I'm going to put the Levites between me and the Israelites as a buffer zone. But the Levites, who are no different and no better than the other 12 tribes, they can come into God's presence. They can come right up against the tabernacle. In fact, they're going to carry the tabernacle around, and God's not going to kill them for it. But if anybody else does it, he'll kill them for it. Why?
Election.
God's choice. It's God saying, I pick, I choose, and I can choose who can come near me. I can say to the whole tribe of Levi, you can come close to my tabernacle. But if anybody from the tribe of, say, Reuben comes near, dead. But Levi, you can come near because I chose you to do this work. The God of the Bible is a God who can say, you can come near me. You can come near me because I say so. You can't come near me. And you can't come near me because I said you can't. You find this God all the way through the Bible. He doesn't change. It's the same personality. It's the same God. Verse 10. So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons that they may keep their priesthood, but the layman who comes near shall be put to death. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, now behold, I have taken the Levites from among the sons of Israel instead of every firstborn, the first issue of the womb among the sons of Israel. So the Levites shall be mine. For all the firstborn are mine on the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. I sanctified to myself all the firstborn in Israel, from man to beast, and they shall be mine. I am the Lord. So there's God's logic. He says, when I brought you out of Egypt, I sanctified all the firstborn to myself by covering them in blood and then protecting their life by that blood. Sacrificial blood that speaks of substitutionary atonement, that speaks of the Passover lamb, that speaks of Christ. He says, as long as I saw the covering blood, I passed over and sanctified. Now, what does that word sanctified mean? Yeah, I set it apart to myself. I made it mine, and I sanctified it by the blood of a sacrifice. And then he says, because they're mine, I can do whatever I want with them. So because I can do whatever I want with your firstborn, I'm going to give them back to you. There's amazing grace. This had to be great news to all the moms. You know, a half hour ago, I said to you all, are you okay with that, giving up your firstborn? And some of you, like Carol, said, In fact, that's exactly what she said. And now God says, you can have your firstborn back. People like Carol would be going, oh, what a relief. Oh, that's such good news. So God just gave up on that thing? Just changed his mind? Just gave up on that whole idea? No, he's taken your whole tribe. Oh, hold on. Can we renegotiate? No, he's taken the whole tribe, all the Levites, all the men are going into service, and all you women married to Levites, you don't get any land inheritance either. You're just going to have to trust God that he's going to take care of you. Well, what about Reuben? Take Reuben's tribe. His tribe's good. What's wrong with Naphtali? Go for him. No, Levi. God chose Levi. And do you know that you can read through the whole Bible and never find one reason why God said, it's Levi. Now, there's nothing in the Bible that says God chose Levi because Levi showed a particular aptitude, or that Levi was strong for carrying, or that Levi was dedicated so he would work in the temple. There's none of that. In fact, as soon as you get your first two sons of a high priest, they go and do the wrong thing and God kills them. There's sufficient evidence that these are not the good ones. But they are also, by the way, the tribe that a particular leader came from. What tribe did Moses come from?
Levi.
So God said, Moses. And then he said, Moses and your brother. Then Moses and your brother and his children. Then Moses and your whole tribe.
There was a point where Levi stood up and killed the people that were sinning against God.
Yeah, but then again, even at that, we don't find any writer who says, and this is the reason God chose them. You know? All right, a couple more verses and we're done. Verse 14, Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, saying, number the sons of Levi by their father's households, by their families, every male from a month old upward, you shall number him. So Moses numbered them according to the word of the Lord, just as he had been commanded. These are the sons of Levi by their names, Gershon and Kohath and Merari. And these are the names of the sons of Gershon by their families, Libni and Shimei, and the sons of Kohath by their families, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel, and the sons of Merari by their families, Mali and Mushi. There's a name that I'm happy fell out of common use. And these are the families of the Levites according to their fathers' households. Of Gershon was the family of the Libnites and the family of the Shimeites, and these were the families of the Gershonites. And their numbered men in the numbering of every male from a month old and upward, even their number of men was 7,500. And the families of the Gershonites were to camp behind the tabernacle westward, and the leader of the fathers of the households of the Gershonites was Eliasaph, who was the son of Lael. Now, we won't go through each of those families. What the book of Numbers then does is it names each of the sons that we just listed, and it tells you how many people altogether they were. Skip to verse 39. By the way, it also says which side of the tabernacle that family group is going to camp on. And he puts one family on the north, one on the south, and one on the west, but then he's going to put the high priest on the east, particularly because that's where the door is, that's where the opening is, so that they can do the daily service there. And then verse 39 tells us that all the numbered men of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron numbered at the command of the Lord by their family, every male from a month upward, were 22,000. And then the Lord said to Moses, number every firstborn male of the sons of Israel from a month old and upward, and make a list of their names. And you shall take the Levites for me, I am the Lord, instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel. And the cattle of the Levites, instead of all the firstborn among the cattle of the sons of Israel. So Moses numbered all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded him, and all the firstborn males by the number of their names from a month old and upward, for the numbered men were 22,273, a difference of 273 people. That was pretty lucky, huh? God just got lucky there. So next week, we're going to pick up right there, and God's going to say, because the Bible is mathematically accurate, God's going to say, hey, there's a 273-person difference here. And he's going to require that they redeem those people so that it works out to the number, man for man, firstborn for Levites. It's a very precise God we're dealing with. That's a God who can say things like we saw on Sunday, I know who my sheep are. I call them by name. He knows how many firstborn. He knows how many Levites. He's a very precise God. If he's saving people, he's saving precise people. All right? All right. Any questions about all that? Wow, I got all that in one night in an hour and 5 minutes. Even with comments, not bad.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.